This is Mame Warren. Today is the 29th of October, 1999. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland with John Barth. And you were just starting to tell me that you were practically conceived at Johns Hopkins.
Well, yes, you know, I used to sail in the Virgin Islands, and they have a t-shirt down there that the locals like to wear saying, "I born here." And sometimes I feel that when I walk around Gilman Hall, I should have that t-shirt on saying, "I reborn here," because my upbringing was across the bay on the Eastern Shore in a little town called Cambridge, where they had only an 11-year school system at a time when almost nobody went to college. And my ambition then was to be a jazz musician. I was playing jazz and orchestrating music for dance bands. So after our 11-year high school, I went up to Juilliard summer school to find out whether what I had was a pre-professional talent or an amateur's flair. And up at Juilliard, I found that the young man on my right and the young woman on my left were going to be the real musicians of their generation, and that mine was more of a flair and a hobby than a real talent. So I came back home prepared to become a soda jerk in my father's soda fountain in Cambridge, but found back in those innocent days that my memory tells me I had actually forgotten that in my senior year, 11th grade, I had taken routinely, along with some of my buddies, a scholarship examination test. So I came home wondering what I was going to do next, and found that I had won a scholarship to Johns Hopkins. So, okay, why not? I don't have anything else to do better than that. You had to pick a major, and I wasn't going to be a scientist. I wasn't going to be a mathematician. I wasn't going to be a historian. What do you pick? There was a major called journalism. So I put down journalism because I'd written a little feature column for our high school paper. Came over and found out that there was this newly established department called Writing, Speech, and Drama. It was, I know now, the second such department in our nation. I think the first creative writing program was the one in Iowa. There were courses at Harvard and other places, but degree-granting programs were a post-World War II phenomenon, except that Iowa had got there just 10 years earlier, I think, a little bit before the Second World War started. When I came up to Hopkins, the place was full of returning veterans and their wives and children and so forth. And I gravitated into this, as a journalism major, into this newly established program, found out that the two things very quickly within the first semester of my freshman year. One, that the journalism program, so-called, consisted of a wonderful old editor from the Sun papers, A.D. Emhart, who was an editorial writer, senior editorial writer for the Sun, who would come down once a week and talk to us about the philosophy of newspaper work. And you went out for the college paper to learn journalism, but that was it for the journalism program. I had no taste for reporting. I didn't have the kind of initiative that goes out and gets the story in that sense. So I figured, no, it's not going to be journalism. But part of the requirements of that major were that one take a course in the introduction to fiction writing or the introduction to poetry. So, all right, I'll try Introduction to Fiction Writing. And in the course of my regular curricular activities, I met Elliot Coleman, the old poet, who was, he seemed old, he wasn't all that old at the time, the gray hair, the silver haired Eminence Glees, who was the head of the Hopkins program, a gentle, scholarly fellow, very kind to us rubes who were coming over from the Eastern Shore. Some marvelous teachers outside the department who became my accidental mentors because they never knew they were my mentors. George Boas in the philosophy department, who was a splendid, dapper, super sophisticated, utterly gentle, very knowledgeable historian of ideas, from whom I got all my education, I suppose. Pedro Salinas, a distinguished old Spanish poet, a refugee from Franco's Spain, who had been first in Puerto Rico and then up at Wellesley and then had landed at Hopkins, and with whom we gringo undergraduates, read Don Quixote in Spanish. But the main thing for me was, because I was getting interested in writing by that time, it was whispered by my classmates that this old fellow is the second most distinguished living Spanish poet after Federico Garcia Lorca, whoever that was. I didn't know. So this was the first, other than Elliot Coleman himself, this was the first living, breathing embodiment of a writer whom I'd ever been in a room with, another enormously gentle and kind fellow who taught, from whom I learned no end about Don Quixote, if not about writing directly. And then my writing coaches, who I now realize were graduate assistants, you know, grown men, veterans of the war, so they didn't look like kids, not like our TAs nowadays, fresh out of their undergraduate college, who were doing their dissertations in the English department, what have you, but were working as coaches for us undergraduate writers. I remember them very well, Lewis Rubin and Robert Jacobs, two people who were my first actual fiction coaches. Now, I had no prior training in the medium. My freight of literature, as W.H. Auden says, all apprentice writers really learn in the library. You know, you really have to download the freight of what Umberto Eco calls the already said. You know, you got to get some notion. You don't start inventing the wheel all over again. I had read very little in my public school, Eastern Shore, semi-rural, semi-redneck primary education. And so the two things that helped me find my vocation, MAME at Johns Hopkins, were, God bless them, these wonderful teachers who were inspiring, you know, one after another in every subject. You know, I just was in a kind of awe taking in what they were saying. And as themselves exemplars of, say, people like Pedro Salinas or George Boas, of the intellectual academic life on the one hand or the writer's life on the other, as a kind of passionate, dignified, noble profession. You know, they were wonderful role models. The other thing that saved my arse and made a writer out of me was that in addition to playing in jazz bands around Baltimore to pay my tuition, I got a job filing books in the old Gilman Hall Library, and my stacks were the stacks of the classics department, what was called then the Oriental Seminary, which is where I met Scheherazade and the Ocean of Story, all these Sanskrit tale cycles and so forth in translation, along with Boccaccio and Rabelais and the wonderful tale tellers from other countries in other periods. And this is what I call my a la carte education, because we weren't exactly told this, but it was understood that they were hiring a lot of these people to help them, a lot of us to help us defray our tuitions. You would take your cart of books, you would go get lost in the stacks, and sooner or later you're expected to show up and get another cart of books, but there was no great pressure to do that. So I was reading off the cart, you know, hence my a la carte education. I was getting a notion of what was there in the first place, a sense of the vastness and multifariousness of literature. And most of the stuff that I was filing was a la carte also in the sense that it was off the regular menu of our very wonderful curricular education. We had wonderful undergraduate courses in the history of classics of Western literature and classics of Western thought, but you wouldn't have found, you know, you would have found Homer and Dante and Virgil and Sophocles and Aeschylus and so forth and company up there. You wouldn't have found Petronius's Satyricon with all its naughty illustrations and so forth. You wouldn't have found The Thousand and One Nights in Burton's translation. You wouldn't have found the Kathasarit Sagara, the Ocean of Story, 17 folio volumes, the longest frame story in the corpus of literature, as far as I know. And I read these damn things virtually from cover to cover. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but what I had to put back on the shelf, I would sometimes go back and get again and take home and absorb. So my literary education came both from the good examples and the good teaching and curricula of the Hopkins Undergraduate College at that time, and from this wonderful off-the-cart, off-the-shelf stuff that I was taking home. Hopkins was a tiny place, was and remains, as you know, a tiny place compared to big state universities where I've taught since and so forth, and an intense place. And the combination, and it's not a residential campus by and large, much less so then in the years just after the war than it is so since it went co-ed and they built some more dormitories and so forth. So we all lived off campus. My impression of the place, I mean, these were my buddies, particularly the veterans, had been through some stuff and they were more mature than us green kids right out of high school. They knew how to drink and get raucous but not get arrested, for example, or pile up their cars. Some of them were married and had children already, which induced a lot of the rest of us following their example to marry at a sort of almost obscenely early age, because the whole push of the 50s in places like that was to become an adult as soon as possible, which we definitely tried to do. It was an enormously serious place, obviously in curricula like the engineering curriculum, where many of my friends were until they dropped out because it was too hard, and the pre-medical curriculum and the science curriculum. The work was gruelingly hard. Hopkins was a like a sort of intellectual Marine boot camp in that regard, I think. But even among us writing majors and English majors and majors in the liberal arts, the tone of the place, as I saw it, MAME, seemed to be that we worked like hell, late into the night, 5 days a week, and you know, and then we binged. So you know, we would party on weekends, and of course I was playing jazz in dance bands downtown on the weekends. So the weeks, my memory was, the weeks seemed like one long day of working very hard at our studies, and then the weekends, you know, we simply partied hard and did all the things that ODing undergraduates do, with binge drinking undergraduates do, but with these older buddies who were sort of anchors to windward, you know, who saw to it that, because they'd been through this before, that we didn't disgrace ourselves or get ourselves expelled, absolutely. Those are pleasant memories. I did get married early, as I mentioned a while ago, following, I think, the examples of so many of my older buddies who were veterans who had wives and children already. And so by my end of my junior year already, I married my then girlfriend, started a family early, and stayed on at Hopkins as a graduate student, partly because I knew the turf by that time and had my first child by that time, needed something to do, and there was Hopkins, which I knew. I could have gone somewhere else to do my graduate work, but I'm on for that.
Now you're jumping ahead for me too much. Okay. I do have a couple of questions. You've mentioned several names that interest me a great deal. I'd like to go into the classroom with you with George Boas. He's somebody I've read a good bit about, and of his works too. Yeah. And I'm very intrigued by him. Take me into the classroom with him.
With pleasure, because it's a delight for me to remember it. George was, I think the extraction there is Spanish, Jewish, a dapper fellow of enormous sophistication and polish, who however was not snobbish at all, who gave the undergraduate curriculum then, for liberal arts majors, consisted of 2-year-long courses. I love to think of that, a 2-year course. The two main core courses were a 2-year course in classics of Western literature. And for those, you brought in the every Eminence Grise when his specialty came. When Homer time came, you brought in the Homer guy, you know, who would lecture for a couple of weeks on the Iliad and the Odyssey. When Dante time came, you brought in the Dante. So us undergraduates in a rather large lecture hall simply got to listen to these marvelous lecturers, you know, talk about these great works of Western literature with this kind of knowledgeable passion with which great teachers can speak about things. Those were marvelous. The phenomenon about Boas was that he taught this 2-year course in classics of Western thought solo. You know, he went from the pre-Socratics right up to the last semester in philosophy. That is almost up to the what would have been regnant then, I guess the French existentialists just during and after World War II. He took us through, the regnant discipline in the philosophy department in those days was the history of ideas. And although that's a somewhat discredited discipline now for philosophers, it's a wonderful way to go at it for undergraduates who are just learning things the first time. We learn that ideas have history. And even the idea that history is unimportant has a long history. And George, it would be typical of Boas that he would take us through that, that notion. You know, let's see where in the history of Western culture the idea has surfaced that history is unimportant. You know, and he would show us that idea has a long history. Among the great things about Boas, he was a splendid lecturer, not at all histrionic, just easy, very proper, very matter-of-fact, very witty lecturer, who had a gift, two important gifts for a lecturer, I think, a gift for illustration. He knew how to give good illuminating examples of what he was talking about when it came to famous philosophical conundra, but also a gift for, as he liked to say himself, for making the strongest possible case for ideas that he himself doesn't agree with. And he was eloquent about that. You know, he would say, if a lot of people have believed an idea, there must be something to it, you know, so let us not, even though it may seem like anathema to us, let's don't dismiss it lightly. Let's see why that idea was so influential for so long and make the best possible case for it that we can. They won't come to me now perhaps, but I remember part of my education from Boas was collecting a lot of these apophthegms and just bits of incidental wisdom that George would drop on us from time to time. Maybe they'll come to me as we're speaking. I had a chance late in his life when I came back to Hopkins. George had a stroke by that time and was not as portable as one could wish he was. But I made a pilgrimage out to his place to let him know that whether he knew it or not, he had been the figure from whom I felt, the one figure from whom I felt I had learned the most during my undergraduate and graduate years at Hopkins, though by no means the only one I had learned a lot from. It was George, by the way. Many of us took master's degrees then, those of us who stayed on, despite the university's policy of not accepting its undergraduates into its graduate program. No good university likes to do that, but any good university will rise above its principles here and there and make some exceptions. So we had this 1 year master's degree program, and then again, because I had children and because I was established in Baltimore as a working jazz musician and so forth, I stayed on yet further in a program that George Boas set up along with Pedro Salinas, the poet, and Elliot Coleman, a serious Hopkins-style doctoral program for those of us who had our MAs in the writing seminars but wanted an honest intellectual PhD. It was called Aesthetics of Literature, and the guiding spirits were Leo Spitzer and another great teacher I forgot to mention before, this Viennese Austrian Jewish refugee from Hitler's terror who settled in Hopkins and was sort of the god of romance philology, I suppose would be the name of his field. One of these people with the Einstein hair and the pure European manner who I remember being in awe of at the time. They set up such an excellent program in Aesthetics of Literature that, as a matter of historical fact, those of us writing aspirant writers who ended up being mainly writers were ones who dropped out of that program, like myself, after a year or so, because we were just out of our depth. You know, it was a program of such high intellectual quality that all the ones who finished it, have you talked to Richard Maxey and the
Humanities?
Maxey was my fellow graduate student in that program at the time. Dick and the other ones who finished that degree, almost without any exceptions, became primarily scholars and critics because the place made intellectual activity so exciting, you know, it was so splendid. They became mainly intellectual scholars and critics who may write the odd poem here and there, you know, someone maybe would publish one novel, but they weren't really congenital novelists, they were doing this sort of with their left hand, but primarily scholars. And the couple of us who became mainly novelists or poets, and only, as it were, with our other hand, became academics, were those who were drowning in that wonderful program because we were out of our depth and dropped out and found something else to do, started teaching instead for a living. So while I wouldn't recommend to any of my own graduate students that they stay on at the place where they did their undergraduate, I think it's good for a writer, by and large, with some exceptions, to have a change of venue, to go to Europe for a while, or Japan, or Africa for a while, or at least, if not Europe, Japan, or Africa, Chicago, or Stanford for a while, have other coaches in another city, another ambiance, just as part of their maturation. I've remembered from my own experience that one should make exceptions to that rule in some cases. I don't think it hurt me to stay on at Hopkins since I had come from such a callow and unformed, though very pleasant, background over on the Eastern Shore. It had everything to learn and was sort of just getting my mind around the fact that there is this huge corpus of Western literature and thought and needed time to sit there and assimilate it with familiar faces and familiar navigation stars for a while before I moved on.
You're the first person I've talked with who's used the word coaches as opposed to mentors. Are you making a distinction there?
Certainly among, maybe not in the intellectual sphere, but in the sphere of writing and probably any practicum courses in the arts. You will have heard, by the way, Mame, if I can digress for just a moment, that the writing program at Hopkins was always regarded with some suspicion and if not downright hostility by the other academic departments on the not unreasonable grounds that Hopkins was founded as America's first research university. You know, its business is intense intellectual academic research. and that practicum courses in the arts belong down at Peabody if you're a musician, Maryland Institute if you're a graphic artist or a sculptor. Writing is sort of in a fishy category there, since it deals with language. You know, it seemed a little closer to what was going on in the general intellectual enterprise of the university than sculpture and musical composition did. So it got in somehow through a side door. But the English departments and the department, the other departments, always looked at it askance and held it at a kind of arm's length. And even now, that feeling resurfaces from time to time if there's a change of administrators and the department may be in for some inclement administrative weather. The feeling this is really not quite right that we'd be doing this kind of thing, raising poets and writers at Johns Hopkins, et cetera, though they've done a distinguished job. What was your question?
The distinction. Okay, using coaching. The word coach rather than mentor.
Right. I dare say that the advisors of doctoral candidates in any field in the university may at that point feel they're doing more coaching than teaching. You know, I'm sure even a master surgeon over at the medical institutions at a while is sort of, you know, let me just take your hand and go this way with the scalpel, rather than saying, no, you understand that the brain is divided into et cetera, et cetera. With writing, it's very clear. When I used to teach, I taught books, of course, as well as teaching writing at Hopkins, but with new apprentices, undergraduate level, let's say, although the muses are not interested in that distinction, undergraduate level apprentices, it is a matter of teaching sometimes. They sometimes need to learn, as I needed to learn, how big literature is, you know, how much has been going on. It's like joining a party that's been going on for a long time before you got there. A lot of the jokes have been told already, you know. And so in order to keep them from just reinventing the wheel over and over again, you need to help steer them into where we are and how we got there. You know, they need to hear about things like modernism and pre-modernism and post-modernism and so forth, just to get their bearings. There's a lot of teaching there. And I used to teach a course in the rudiments of fiction, in which we talk about, you know, how come it is that stories seem to go this way, building up to a climax and then down, rather than going the other way, you know, with the climax up front. You know, why do we tell jokes with the punchline at the end rather than the beginning? What have writers in most cultures, in most centuries, what are some of the devices that they seem to have learned are most effective for getting a story told? Let's look at some of them. You know, why do you need dialogue? You know, why, et cetera. Beginning, middle, and end, why have them in that order, et cetera. I like to talk about those things to beginners. That's teaching. By the time we pick our graduate student poets and fiction writers, we pick them for their talent in the first place, which means that most of them, if they're not publishing already, if they're not beginning to publish already, are about 5 millimeters away from professionality. And that's the hardest little gap to close sometimes. So there, it becomes more a matter of coaching. There, it really matters, you know, you're doing a great many things almost professionally well already, if not professionally well. Maybe just here, you know, and there I have that feeling almost metaphorically of taking their hand, you know, and say, how about this image instead of that image? Why not put this character back here instead of over here, you know? Or as Joe Heller used to say, you got too many guys on the payroll, you know, let's see if we can't cut down the budget, combine these two characters for efficiency's sake and so that we don't think the union will object, and see if we can't get the job done sooner. Is it a good idea to have her do this before she does that rather than do that before she does this? That's coaching at that point. You're not instructing them in any general principles. You're just helping them be a better version, a more likely professional version of what they almost are already. It's very labor intensive. It's why Robert Stone, for example, whom we very much liked as a teacher, left as early as he did from the program. He had been teaching only undergraduate writers at Amherst, and he didn't realize, he had never taught graduate student writers before, who were often staggeringly ambitious, staggeringly productive, and whose work is already at a high enough level of finish that it's enormously time intensive. It involves really reading the manuscript several times and line editing them almost word for word, you know, applauding here and clucking your tongue over here and making a suggestion here. He found it was taking up all his time as a writer. And so he went up to Yale, where I'm interested to hear. We liked him, he liked us, I think, but it's too much work. Up to Yale, where he's teaching only undergraduates again. Which means we're going to read Conrad today, and I'll look at your manuscripts, but he's going to say, you know, like, a little too long, you know, et cetera. See if you can shorten this by 3 pages and show it to me again.
It takes a little less time. Another name you mentioned who interests me a great deal, and I don't even know how long he was here, is Louis Rubin.
Yes, Louis Rubin. I forgot to mention Carl Shapiro, too, who was the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, whom I didn't have as a teacher, but he was one of those pleasant presences in the germinal department of writing speech and drama. Elliot Coleman, Carl Shapiro went from here out to Chicago. An old fellow who was a Poe specialist, who used to teach the so-called drama end of the department, which meant it was him in the way that ADM art was the journalism. Her name, N. Berillion Fagan, an old Catholic.
What was his name?
Fagan, F-A-G-I-N, just like the guy in Dickens's novel. Mm-hmm. Berillion was his first name, N, the initial N, and then middle name, something like the element, but it was B-R-Y-L-L-I-O-N, I think, Berillion Fagan. Talked about Poe, and then an important guy for me, a Catholic-trained scholar named Francis Thompson, who took us all through the history of criticism, but also was the Joyce specialist. And in those days, since the English department didn't teach writers that modern, if you wanted to learn about Proust and Joyce and Thomas Mann and so forth, you learned it from the guys who were teaching in the writing seminars, or from the appropriate language departments. We had a seminar. Thompson had a seminar in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake that went on every Tuesday night forever. And I took it for about 3 years. We would go over and read from the book. He would get mathematicians, scientists, and so forth to pick up Joyce's allusions to these things. And when we got to the book itself, as you know, it ends in the middle of a sentence and circles back to its beginning. And that's the way we read it. We would have a kind of Simchas Torah. When we got to the end of the book, we'd all break open some Irish beer or something and have a little celebration and then start right over again at sentence number one. Wonderful education in Joyce. Louis Rubin, like my first writing teacher, Robert Jacobs, was then a war veteran graduate student doing his PhD. Either in the English department or in this department of this interdepartmental program in aesthetics of literature, who was instructed to coach our young fiction writers and ended up coaching the graduate seminar in fiction writing as well. His specialty was and remains Southern literature and Southern history, but he too was a very understanding and insightful coach and important in helping me write out all the crap that young writers have in their system and try and find out who they are and so forth. Still very much alive, retired from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I know people he's been very influential to.
Yeah, indeed so.
And I really hadn't, was he here very long?
He was here for the time it took him to complete his own degree, which I'm going to guess was probably the last 3 years of my undergraduate education, probably, and I know he was here during the year I was taking my master's degree because he presided over the graduate seminar that year. Mm-hmm. Then I think he left to go down and take a job. He founded the writing program at Hollins College, a very good one, and then moved on to Chapel Hill, where he became a professor of Southern history and of mm-hmm. Southern literature at Chapel Hill until his retirement. Yeah, and a good guy. All these were good guys, not as remote as those eminence greases like Leo Spitzer and George Boas and so forth. They were more closer to our age, and they were started out as our TAs and so forth, so we felt more bonded to them than we did to the other chaps. May I pour you some water?
Yeah, I'm getting a little low. Thank you.
There you go.
So you were really a witness to the evolution of writing speech and drama into the writing seminars.
Evolution is the wrong term. I was a witness to the devolution of it. It was the evolution of the program. It had just started the year before I got there. Russell Baker and some others were charter members of the students in the program. I came the year after it was established. And it had that little period of prosperity during the 4 years of my undergraduate tenure and my undergraduate residency and the 1 year of my MA residency, and then hit some adverse administrative weather, which, the hostility from other departments, and was had the rug pulled out from under it, had its budget blasted away, so that it devolved, and they stripped off, not without some justification, they stripped off the drama and speech thing, which was only a marginal operation, and the journalism thing, which was only a marginal operation anyway. They stripped it of departmental status, although it was still budgetarily and administratively autonomous. They wouldn't call it a department anymore. This was not the department's decision. It was some deanly, provostly decision. And it became the writing seminars, which just meant that you had a seminar in fiction, a seminar in poetry, and that was about it, and some undergraduate introductory courses. Because the budget was cut, all those lovely professors left, and it became, for the next 10 or 15, almost 20 years, it became just Elliot Coleman, a couple of stringers, sort of nameless stringers, teaching the fiction and the poetry. Elliot's still lecturing on Marcel Proust and giving master classes in poetry, and a little bit of help from some alumni of the program, like Dick Maxey, who had established their own academic base over in the Humanities Center, etc., and lent some support to Elliot. It lingered in this kind of twilight, I'm going to say 15 years, 20 years. When I left in 1965, to go teach at Penn State and then at Buffalo and then at Boston U and so forth. It was in pretty feeble case, and it remained that way. As Elliot got older and was approaching retirement, and I was deciding whether to stay at Boston U, go back to Buffalo, or come down to Hopkins, it really was in limp condition. And I spoke to the then provost, George Owen, and to Steve Muller, the then president. We all agreed on what the state of affairs was, and I told them that it seemed to me one of two things had to be done. Elliot was about to retire. They could either phase out the program gently at his retirement and let the adjuncts go. It would have been no Saturday Night Massacre, because those were not tenured members of the faculty anyway, and just let the program go and let Hopkins go back to what it had been before the thing was established. Or they could hire me, quintuple the department's budget, let me find a chairman, because I can't administer anything, let me find a chairman, let the chairman make two or three good appointments immediately, give us plenty of office space, and let's get back to something like where we were in the beginning. And I deliberately accepted a joint appointment with the English department at their invitation, thinking that might build some bridges between what had been historically not always a very friendly relationship. And that all worked very well. I felt welcomed there by the English department as well as by the faculty, by the administration. I found a chairman, Charles Newman, who was editor of the, he was out at Northwestern University and editing a good literary magazine, Tri-Quarterly. He came in, he's a strong intellect. My notion was that, it being Hopkins, what we needed for a chairman was not just a poet or a fiction writer. We needed somebody who was a first-rate intellectual, who could hold his own with all these people up and down Gilman Hall, who also was a critic or a good critic or a fiction writer or a poet, but who had this strong academic intellectual string to his or her bow, or else they'd be killed in that environment. Charlie Newman was just that kind of thing. He came in, he smashed a lot of necessary crockery that needed smashing, but built a lot of bridges as well, got us the office space, got us the appointments, got tired of the job. And then we hired John Irwin, who had been there as a doctoral candidate in English, had gone down to the University of Georgia to found the Georgia Review, who is himself a first-rate critic. And then under a nom de plume, I think one of our really first-rate poets, he writes under a pseudonym as a poet, and he came in and then really put the department on its feet. So for the next 20 years, under John's leadership, the department, in my opinion, flourished. John has now stepped down as chairman. I've retired. Some of our other people have left. And so the department is in temporarily vulnerable condition now, in a way that reminds me of the situation 50 years ago, etc. But we've acquired enough powerful alumni, and there are enough good people still on the faculty, that I don't think the department is in any danger of being kneecapped or otherwise sabotage. No, we've got so many. Most of our graduates, as you can imagine, ma'am, do not grow up to be professional writers any more than most Peabody graduates grow up to be concert pianists. They often go into other fields, sometimes related to writing. They may become editors or advertising writers or PR people and so forth. Some of them, a surprising fraction of them, become lawyers. Some become very wealthy. Some of them endow the university. One of them has even endowed the chair that the current dean is sitting in, for example. And so when trouble comes, as it has done in this past year, the department has a lot of alumni muscle that it can flex if it needs to without things getting really unpleasant, just to remind anybody who needs reminding that it has been a very popular major, even among those who don't turn out to be working professional writers. But some of them too, like Russ Baker and William Styron's wife, Rose, who was a classmate of mine, et cetera, and is a poet in her own right, et cetera. So if we need to flex a little muscle, we can do it, although we try to do this kind of thing delicately so that we can remain on colleagly terms with the other departments. In fact, it makes me sort of proud of Hopkins that even after this many decades, they can look askance at something like writing in the university, that it really ought to. And every time one of my good MA candidates or MA people decides that she or he wants to do a PhD somewhere at Hopkins in some other department, I warn them that that's fine, and if you've got this academic string to your bow too, that's terrific. But if you're going to do it at Hopkins, you're going to have to be prepared to set your muse aside for the next 2 or 3 years, and that's hard for a young writer to do. Some of our people have done that, and I warn them that, given my experience that I mentioned before, they may find that they'll end up being mainly scholars and critics because Hopkins is going to make intellectual activity seem like such a pleasant thing to do. But they may have trouble hearing their other muse calling in their other ear.
So we seem to have worked our way around to teaching, mm-hmm. which is just fine with me.
How are we doing on the clock?
We're just fine for me.
Yeah, good.
Take me into the classroom with John Barth. One thing I want to know, you've talked about Gilman Hall. Did you ever teach in that classroom up at the top of the tower?
I loved it. That was a late acquisition.
I love that room.
So do I. Right up under the clock, nothing above us except time itself. And looking out over the campus there. John Irwin scored us that room some time ago, and it's terrific. But the classical room in which so much happened in my undergraduate days, and then when I came back to teach undergraduates, was Gilman 38, just a nondescript basement room in Gilman, which has a wonderful literary history. The wastebasket in there, for example, at least the one that used to be in there, was thrown up in by Dylan Thomas, for example, when he came through to give one of his, this guy would get staggeringly drunk, and so we think the guy, he cannot possibly be perpendicular when he goes on stage. And at one time, Elliot Coleman was walking around in the rain. He threw up in the wastebasket of Gilman Hall, of Gilman 38, and then walked on stage in the lecture hall, which I think was a chemistry lecture hall, Remsen 101, with the periodic table behind his head. And as Thomas could do, from the minute he stepped through the door of the room, you wouldn't know he had a thing to drink, and he would give one of these absolutely transfixing, exhilarating readings of his own and other people's poetry and so forth. Gilman 38 was the seminar room for the old writing seminars, and it's where most of us went through the crucible of having our apprentice works. These were in the days before photocopying and so forth, so the author had to read. We had mimeograph machines, but by and large the author had to read. These were okay for poets, but for fiction writers to have to sit there and you had to listen, and you're already out of the medium because you're in the oral tradition by that time rather than the written tradition. And your classmates trying to remember what they had just heard enough to make criticisms. That's where it all happened in Gilman 38. So that's the one I remember as my crucible. I was pleased that when I came back to Hopkins 20-some years later, that room was still in operation for the writing seminar. So I was able to tell my young students and coaches some of the things that had gone on in that room in years past, that Bill Styron sat here at this end of the table and told me such and such about an awful piece that I was chosen to read to him when he came through and I was a student that Dylan Thomas had thrown up, if not in that very wastebasket, in one just like it over there, and that you may do the same someday. But then that upper room, that's wonderful, the idea of leaving the campus, the other operations of the campus, physically below you and ascending that last flight of stairs that even the elevator doesn't go up to, you know, as if to say, the muses and other things, I mean, your other things can take you only so far, but then it's just you and the muse going up this last flight of steps to this elevated venue.
So how many people would be sitting around the table?
Well, in the advanced, so-called advanced undergraduate classes, that is advanced in the sense that those there too, they apply for admission and we pick them on the basis that they've mastered some of the rudiments already and they're ready for some fine tuning. As in the graduate seminar, 12 is a high number, but it's a typical number. You know, anything less than 12 is a nice small house. Anything more than 12, in fiction particularly, is an awful lot of work because you add one more student and you've got a lot more pages of manuscript to line edit and have conferences with them about and so forth. We try hard as our department. The three fiction writers on the staff, most of the time I was there, Steve Dixon and Gene McGarry and myself, have very different tastes in literature. We're very different kinds of writers, and it pleases me that we seldom disagreed about the merits of a candidate for the graduate program. We take it as an article of faith that we don't have any particular literary ideology. You know, we're not looking for postmodernists, whatever that is, or for traditional realists or anything. We just want people who are doing things promisingly well that we think we can help to do it a little better. And so, with a few exceptions, no matter what kind of stuff the candidate's writing, whether it's straight out of the, you know, Ray Carver, Hemingway, realistic, minimalist vein, or whether it's, you know, formal, explosively formal tricksiness of some kind of post-postmodern variety, we're usually able to say, you know, this is not very interesting, or this is really sharp. You know, this person's really good at what he or she's doing, and we think we can be of some assistance there. And so, typically, particularly in the graduate program, the mix of ideologies of where these people are coming from muse-wise is healthily various. And there has been a prevailing tone in the room that pleases me. I don't know whether it comes out of the walls of Gilman Hall and the history of all the people who've taught and learned there. A wonderful combination of non-competitiveness. I've heard, for example, very contrasting stories from people who've come from the Iowa program to us, for example, or gone from us out to the Iowa program. Of course, it's competitive in a way, but it's not sabotaging, kneecapping competitive. A wonderful combination of critical candor and reciprocal respect. I don't know whether it comes down from the head end of the table or comes up to the head end of the table from the people in the room. But one of the things that I certainly tried to do as their coach was remind them that how various literature is, you know, and how many of the things that might be regarded as postmodern tricks you can find in Sanskrit literature from the 10th century, you know, or in Shakespeare's plays at such and such a point, or here or there, that, as I told you a moment ago, the size of the already said is enormous, you know, and that you're not likely to do anything for the first time in an art that's been going on as long as storytelling, and by this time story writing has done. So they do learn, most of them, to be a little more pluralistic than perhaps in their tastes, than perhaps they were when they came into the program, to learn that there are more ways to the woods than one, and that the trick is not, the important thing is not what you're writing about, where it's coming from, or what aesthetic principles you may believe you subscribe to for the present, but just how well you're doing. You know, does this knock my socks off? You know, is this a metaphor we want to applaud? Was that a wonderful coup de théâtre, one that Shakespeare or Cervantes or Rabelais might have applauded, etc. When that works, it's a good feeling. So while there will be sometimes rivalries and even enmities among the students, especially when if sex or romance gets involved among some of the young writers in the room, by and large, the tone of things is civilized but candid, sharp but diplomatic. And the students, by their own report, find enormously supportive. They learn, of course, much more from one another than they do from whoever's at the head end of the room. The conversation in the room is one thing, and in our office conference is another. But if they're like I was and my buddies back in those days, and I'm sure they are, the conversation just goes on and on and on and on and on, you know, with the all-night parties. And if they're going down to Fells Point, it's still the seminar, you know, going on.
We're going to run out of tape if we go
okay.
on and on
well,
here.
I think we've
Let me turn it over.
What do you want your students to learn most? What is it that you most want them to take away from the
well,
experience?
One of the things they seem to take away, though it's not necessarily high on my agenda, one fellow, in one writer in an interview for somewhere or other later on when he was reminiscing about the seminars and about my seminar, said that among other things, it's a good exercise, and it's a good training school in academic critical deportment. He said, now that may be the kind of thing I was just saying, you know, where you learn to make your point, you know, but not try to bludgeon your fellow writer over the head. A little bit of candor combined, a little bit of diplomacy combined with the candor or something. What I want them to learn, I think I've made clear, Mame, already, what I hope they'll carry away from it. That's my wife. We're supposed to go bike riding in a few minutes. If they don't know, if they don't have it already, I want them to get some improved sense of the width and the depth of literature, you know, the enormous variety of things that there are to admire, how many kind, and not lock themselves in to one kind of writing or one kind of writer and use that writer or writing to bang on the head. Other ways of doing things, to learn that there are many ways to be splendid. That would be one thing. For another, even in the case of the graduate students, in fiction, this would not be so true in poetry as it wouldn't be in theoretical physics or chess or mathematics. In fiction, maturation can take a very long time. And so the other thing I try to remind them, impress upon them, is that seldom does it happen that a young writer right out of graduate school is going to go, you know, find a New York agent and be right on the stands in a hurry. If you're a violinist, it probably either happens early or it's not going to happen at all. But the novel, particularly, is a medium that's very kind to slow growers, and that those who do not find their voice by the time they're 25 or 30, by no means need to give up. They feel they've got to find something else to do to pay the rent, perhaps, you know, and they do. A number of them become lawyers, they become these other things I was talking about. But it's always a delight to me, and not so surprising, that sometimes when they reach their 40s or even 50, the first novel will come along and it'll get published. The novel, I remind my young coachees, as a genre, was invented by middle-aged people. It's been a genre in which somebody, unlike any other art form I know of, can do it right the first time at age 50 or 55 mm-hmm. sometimes. I don't know of any other medium of art in which that's true. We have lots of Grandma Moses in fiction, you know, but not so many in the plastic arts. That, I think, is useful to learn. So even if they decide, discouraged, that it isn't working yet, you know, and maybe I better go to law school the way Dad wanted me to in the first place, and they do, and they get their law degree, and they practice. There are two or three cases among my own former students where then the novels start to appear, you know, and they become the Michael Crichton or who have you of their generation.
Okay, one
so
last question.
So patience with their muse, a sense of the length, width, and depth of the literary corpus, you know, that there are many more ways to the woods than one.
One last question. If you were to describe Johns Hopkins as a personality, how would you do it?
I've never thought of Johns Hopkins as a personality. And no doubt it has changed. I think it's probably a little more humane place than it used to think of itself as being back in my student days. Let me tell you the anecdote very quickly of a fellow graduate student of mine back in those days, a graduate student in the English department, who used to have nightmares about his upcoming PhD oral exams. The boat is sunk, we're all in the water, we're trying to get our hands on the gunwales of the lifeboats, and our professors are up there with the hatchets chopping off our fingers. You know, that was the Hopkins, at least on the graduate level, that he thought of in those days. That fellow grew up to become chairman of the English department for a while, and when I met him later on, he'd been other places. I said, "So now, Jack, it's you up there with the fire axe, right, chopping off the fingers." And he says, "I try to just pry the fingers off gently without chopping them." I suspect the place is a little gentler in that regard than it used to be. But I did used to like to think of it, maybe because I had all these Marine and Army, Navy veteran buddies as an undergraduate. I think it used to like to think of itself, and we certainly thought of it, as I mentioned before, as a kind of Paris Island or other boot camp of the academic world, where they were deadly serious. Social life at Hopkins was never a big deal. Your social life was over in those row houses and fraternity houses off the campus, you know. But it was anything, it was the opposite of a party school. Bloody serious, but high intellectual adventure, rigorous standards, which I still admire enormously and I hope are still being maintained in other departments as they are in our writing seminars. And then, you know, just blowing it off on the weekends and the free time. I like that idea of working very hard, working very hard, working very hard, and then playing hard on the, you know, on the time between when you're working hard. I suspect that when the university went co-ed, I hope and suspect that that may have gentled the aspect a little bit, that there may be, I hope it's still competitive. I hope the standards are still rigorous. But it wouldn't hurt if things were a little less boot campy over on the Homewood campus than they were. And my sense as a teacher there in the 1970s and 80s and into the 90s was that that was the case, that life was a little bit gentler.
Do you think co-education made a difference?
I don't know if it made the difference, but I think that there was there's a correlation. Whether there was causation among the correlation or not, it would be presumptuous of me to say. Mm-hmm. I know that it was a strange thing for me, after being a student at Hopkins and then a TA at Hopkins, to go off to Penn State and for the first time have women in the classroom. I thought this was so delightful. I loved it immediately, you know. It didn't seem somehow immediately as serious as it was back in my undergraduate days. But it was so much more pleasanter and more human. And then, of course, I had some wonderful students, including my wife, who's waiting for me now, so that we can go biking. Then when I came back to Hopkins, it was by then a co-educational institution. And the graduate school, mind you, was always co-educational, so there were always women on the campus, high-performing ones. By that time, of course, it seemed the most natural thing in the world that some of my best undergraduate students were the women students, that it wasn't an all male. It seemed queer by that time. It seemed odd to think that once this was an all-male bastion, you know, with no female voices in the room, that seemed so strange, as if you would have, what, all dwarfs or all one-handed people or something like that. It just seemed very strange. Well, Mae, I think we can, if you're finished.
I could go on for a long time, but I am perfectly satisfied. I want to thank you so very much.
Well, I thank you for being patient with the...